Agnes was aware of something happening backstage. Little groups of men were forming, and then breaking up as various individuals hurried away about their mysterious tasks. Out in front, the orchestra was already tuning up. The chorus was filing on to be a busy marketplace, in which various jugglers, gypsies, sword-swallowers, and gaily dressed yokels would be entirely unsurprised at an apparently drunken baritone strolling on to sing an enormous amount of plot at a passing tenor. She saw Mr. Bucket and Mr. Salzella deep in argument with the stage manager.
"How can we search the entire building? This place is a maze. He might have just wandered off somewhere."
"He's as blind as a bat without those glasses."
"But we can't be certain something's happened to him."
"Oh, yes. You didn't say that when we opened the double bass case. You were certain he was going to be inside. Admit it."
I wasn't expecting just to find a smashed double bass, yes. But I was feeling a bit mithered at that point."
A sword swallower nudged Agnes.
"What?"
"Curtain up in 1 minute, dear," he said, smearing mustard on his sword.
"Has something happened to Dr. Undershaft?"
"Couldn't say, dear. You wouldn't have any salt, would you?"
"Excuse me. Excuse me. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. Oh, was that your foot? Oh, excuse me."
Leaving a trail of annoyed and pained patrons in their wake, the witches trod their way to their seats. Granny elbowed herself comfortable and then, having in some matters the boredom threshold of a 4-year-old, said,
"What's happening now?"
Nanny's skimpy knowledge of opera didn't come to her aid, so she turned to the lady beside her.
"Excuse me, could I borrow your programme?
Thank you."
"Excuse me, could I borrow your spectacles? So kind."
She spent a few moments in careful study.
"This is the overture," she said. "It's kind of a free sample of what's going to happen. It's got a summary of the story, too. La Triviata."
Her lips moved as she read. Occasionally, her brow wrinkled.
"Well, it's quite simple, really," she said at last. "A lot of people are in love with one another. There's considerable dressing up as other people and general confusion. There's a cheeky servant. No one really knows who anyone is. A couple of old dukes go mad. Chorus of gypsies, etc. Your basic opera. Someone's probably going to turn out to be someone else's long-lost son or daughter or wife or something."
"Shh!"
said a voice behind them.
"Wish we'd brought something to eat," muttered Granny.
"I think I've got some peppermints in my knicker leg."
"Shh! I would like my spectacles back, please."
"Here you are, Mum. They're not very good, are they?"
Someone tapped Nanny Ogg on the shoulder.
"Madam, your first owl is eating my chocolates."
And someone tapped Granny Weatherwax on her shoulder.
"Madam, kindly remove your hat."
Nanny Ogg choked on her peppermint. Granny Weatherwax turned to the red-faced gentleman behind her.
"You do know what a woman in a pointy hat is, don't you?" she said.
"Yes, madam. A woman in a pointy hat is sitting in front of me."
Granny gave him a stare, and then, to Nanny's surprise, she removed her hat.
"I do beg your pardon," she said. "I can see I was inadvertently bad-mannered. Pray excuse me."
She turned back to the stage. Nanny Ogg started breathing again.
"You feeling all right, Esme?"
"Never better."
Granny Weatherwax surveyed the auditorium, oblivious to the sounds around her.
"I assure you, madam, your fur is eating my chocolates. It started on the second layer."
"Oh, dear. Show him the little map inside the lid, will you? He's only after the truffles, and you can soon rub the dribble off the others."
"Do you mind being quiet?"
"I don't mind. It's this man and his chocolates that's making the noise."
A big room, Granny thought. A great big room without windows. There was a tingling in her thumbs. She looked at the chandelier. The rope disappeared into an alcove in the ceiling. Her gaze passed along the rows of boxes. They were all quite crowded. On one, though, the curtains were almost closed, as if someone inside wanted to see out without being seen. Then Granny looked among the stalls. The audience was mainly human. Here and there was the hulking shape of a troll, although the troll equivalent of operas usually went on for a couple of years. A few dwarf helmets gleamed, although dwarfs normally weren't interested in anything without dwarfs in. There seemed to be a lot of feathers down there, and here and there the glint of jewellery. Shoulders were being worn bare this season. A lot of attention had been paid to appearances. The people were here to look, not to see. She closed her eyes. This was when you started being a witch.
It wasn't when you did headology on daft old men, or mixed up medicines, or stuck up for yourself, or knew one herb from another. It was when you opened your mind to the world and carefully examined everything it picked up. She ignored her ears until the sounds of the audience became just a distant buzz. Or at least a distant buzz broken by the voice of Nanny Ogg. "Says here that Dame Timpani, who sings the part of Quizzella, is a diver," said Nanny. "So I reckon this is like a part-time job, then. Probably quite a good idea on account of you have to be able to hold your breath. Good training for the singing." Granny nodded without opening her eyes. She kept them closed as the opera started. Nanny, who knew when to leave her friend to her own devices, tried to keep quiet but felt impelled to give out a running commentary. Then she said, "Ah, oh, there's Agnes! Hey, hey, that's Agnes!" "Stop waving and sit down," murmured Granny, trying to hold on to her waking dream. Nanny leaned over the balcony. "She's dressed up as a gypsy," she said, "and now there's a girl coming forward to sing." She peered at the stolen programme. "The famous Departure Aria, it says here. Now that's what I call a good voice."
"That's Agnes singing," said Granny.
"No, it's this girl, Christine."
"Shut your eyes, you daft old woman, and tell me if that isn't Agnes singing," said Granny.
Nanny Ogg obediently shut her eyes for a moment and then opened them again.
"It's Agnes singing!"
"Yes.
But there's that girl with a big smile right out there in front, moving her lips and everything."
"Yes."
Nanny scratched her head. "Something a bit wrong here, Esme. Can't have people stealing our Agnes's voice." Granny's eyes were still shut.
"Tell me if the curtains on that box down there on the right have moved," she said.
"I just saw them twitch, Esme."
"Ah."
Granny let herself relax again. She sank into the seat as the aria washed over her and opened her mind once more. Edges, walls, doors. Once a space was enclosed, it became a universe of its own. Some things remained trapped in it. The music passed through one side of her head and out the other, but with it came other things, strands of things, echoes of old screams. She drifted down further, down below the conscious, into the darkness beyond the circle of firelight. There was fear here. It stalked the place like a great dark animal. It lurked in every corner. It was in the stones. Old terror crouched in the shadows. It was one of the most ancient terrors, the one that meant that no sooner had mankind learned to walk on two legs than it dropped to its knees. It was the terror of impermanence, the knowledge that all this would pass away, that a beautiful voice or a wonderful figure was something whose arrival you couldn't control and whose departure you couldn't delay. It wasn't what she'd been looking for, but it was perhaps the sea in which it swam. She went deeper. And there it was, roaring through the night-time of the soul of the place like a deep, cold current. As she drew closer, she saw that it was not one thing, but two, twisted around one another. She reached out. Trickery, lies, deceit, murder. No! She blinked. Everyone had turned to look at her. Nanny tugged at her dress.
Sit down, Esme!
Granny stared. The chandelier hung peacefully over the crowded seats.
They beat him to death.
What's that, Esme? And they throw him into the river.
Esme,
shh, madam, will you sit down at once? And now it's started on the Noongar Whirls.
Granny snatched at her hat and did a crabwise run along the row, crushing some of the finest footwear in Ankh-Morpork under her thick Lancre soles. Nanny hung back reluctantly. She'd quite enjoyed the song and she wanted to applaud, but her pair of hands wasn't necessary. The audience had exploded as soon as the last note had died away. Nanny Ogg looked at the stage and took note of something and smiled.
Like that, eh?
Githa!
She sighed.
Coming, Esme. Excuse me.
Granny Weatherwax was out in the red plush corridor, leaning with her forehead against the wall.
This is a bad one, Githa, she muttered. It's all twisted up. I ain't at all sure I can make it happen right. The poor soul...
She straightened up.
Look at me, Githa, will you?
Githa obediently opened her eyes wide. She winced a little as a fragment of Granny Weatherwax's consciousness crept behind her eyes. Granny put her hat on, tucking in the occasional errant wisp of grey hair, and then taking one by one the 8 hatpins and ramming them home with the same frowning deliberation with which a mercenary might check his weapons.
All right, she said at last.
Nanny Ogg relaxed.
It's not that I mind, Esme, she said, but I wish you'd use a mirror.
Waste of money, said Granny.
Now fully armoured, she strode off along the corridor.
"Glad to see you didn't lose your temper with the man who went on about your hat," said Nanny, running along behind.
"No point. He's going to be dead tomorrow."
"Oh, dear. What of?"
"Run over by a cart, I think."
"Why didn't you tell him?"
"I could be wrong."
Granny reached the stairs and thundered down them. "Where are we going?
I want to see who's behind those curtains."
The applause, distant but still thunderous, filled the stairwell.
"They certainly like Agnes's voice," said Nanny. "Yes, I hope we're in time."
"Oh, bugger."
"What?"
"I left Grebo up there."
"Merely likes meeting new people. Good grief, this place is a maze."
Granny stepped out into a curved corridor, rather plusher than the one they had left. There was a series of doors along it.
"Ah, now then."
She walked along the row, counting, and then tried a handle.
"Can I help you, ladies?"
They turned. A little old woman had come up softly behind them, carrying a tray of drinks. Granny smiled at her. Nanny Ogg smiled at the tray.
"We were just wondering," said Granny, "which person in these boxes likes to sit with the curtains nearly shut?"
The tray began to shake.
"Here, shall I hold that for you?" said Nanny. "You'll spill something if you're not careful." "What do you know about box 8?
Said the old lady.
"Ah, box 8, said Granny. "That'd be the one, yes. That's this one over here, isn't it?"
"No, please."
Granny strode forward and grasped the handle. The door was locked. The tray was thrust into Nanny's welcoming hands.
"Well, thank you. I don't mind if I do," she said.
The woman pulled at Granny's arm.
"Don't! It'll bring terrible bad luck."
Granny thrust out her hand.
"The king, madam."
Behind her, Nanny inspected a glass of champagne.
"Don't make him angry. It's bad enough as it is."
The woman was clearly terrified.
"Iron," said Granny, rattling the handle. "Can't magic iron."
"Here,"
said Nanny, stepping forward a little unsteadily.
"Give me one of your hatpins. Our Nev's taught me all kinds of tricks."
Granny's hand rose to her hat, and then she looked at Mrs. Plinge's lined face. She lowered her hand.
"No," she said. "No, I reckon we'll leave it for now."
"I don't know what's happening," sobbed Mrs. Plinge. "It never used to be like this."
"Have a good blow," said Nanny, handing her a grubby handkerchief and patting her kindly on the back.
"There was none of this killing people. He just wanted somewhere to watch the opera. It made him feel better."
"Who's this we're talking about?" said Granny.
Nanny Ogg gave her a warning look over the top of the old woman's head. There were some things best left to Nanny.
"He'd unlock it for an hour every Friday for me to tidy up, and there was always his little note saying thank you or apologising for the chocolates down the seat. And where was the harm in it? That's what I'd like to know."
"Have another good blow," said Nanny.
"And now there's people dropping like flies out of the flies. They say it's him, but I know he never meant any harm."
"Course not," said Nanny soothingly.
"Many's the time I've seen them look up at the box. They always felt the better for it if they saw him. And then poor Mr. Pounder was strangulated. I looked around and there was his hat, just like that."
"It's terrible when that happens," said Nanny Ogg.
"What's your name, dear?"
"Mrs. Plinge," sniffed Mrs. Plinge. "It came right down in front of me. I'd have recognised it anywhere."
"I think it would be a good idea if we took you home, Mrs. Plinge," said Granny.
"Oh, dear, I've got all these ladies and gentlemen to see to. And anyway, it's dangerous going home this time of night. Walter walks me home, but he's got to stay late tonight. Oh, dear."
"Have another good blow," said Nanny. "Find a bit that isn't too soggy." There was a series of sharp pops. Granny Weatherwax had interlocked her fingers and extended her hands at arm's length so that her knuckles cracked.
"Dangerous, eh?" she said. "Well, we can't see you all upset like this. I'll walk you home, and Mrs. Ogg will see to things here."
"Only I've got to attend to the boxes. I've got all these drinks to serve. Could have sworn I had them a moment ago."
"Mrs. Ogg knows all about drinks," said Granny, glaring at her friend.
"There's nothing I don't know about drinks,"
agreed Nanny, shamelessly emptying the last glass.
"Especially these." And what about our Walter? He'll worry himself silly."
"Walter's your son," said Granny. "Where's a beret?"
The old woman nodded.
"Only I always comes back for him if he's working late," she began.
"You come back for him, but he sees you home," said Granny.
"It's... Well, he's...
Mrs. Plinge rallied.
"He's a good boy," she said defiantly.
"I'm sure he is, Mrs. Plinge," said Granny. She carefully lifted the little white bonnet off Mrs. Plinge's head and handed it to Nanny, who put it on and also took the little white apron. That was the good thing about black. You could be nearly anything wearing black, Mother Superior or Madam. It was really just a matter of the style. It just depended on the details. There was a click. Box 8 had bolted itself. And then there was the very faint scrape of a chair being wedged under the door handle. Granny smiled and took Mrs. Plinge's arm. "I'll be back as soon as I can," she said. Nanny nodded and watched them go. There was a little cupboard at the end of the corridor. It contained a stool, Mrs. Plinge's knitting, and a small but very well-stocked bar. There were also, on a polished mahogany plank, a number of bells on big coiled springs. Several of them were bouncing up and down angrily. Nanny poured herself a gin, and gin with a dash of gin, and inspected the rows of bottles with considerable interest. Another bell started to ring. There was a huge jar of stuffed olives. Nanny helped herself to a handful and blew the dust off a bottle of port. A bell fell off its spring. Somewhere out in the corridor, a door opened and a young man's voice bellowed, "Where are those drinks, woman?" Nanny tried the port. Nanny Ogg was used to the idea of domestic service. As a girl, she'd been a maid at Lancre Castle, where the king was inclined to press his intentions and anything else he could get hold of. Young Githa Ogg had already lost her innocence, without regret, since she hadn't found any use for it, but she had some clear ideas about unwelcome intentions, and when he jumped out at her in the scullery, she had technically committed treason with a large leg of lamb swung in both hands. That had ended her life below stairs and put a lengthy crimp in the king's activities above them. The brief experience had given her certain views, which weren't anything so definite as political, but were firmly Oggish. And Mrs. Plinge had looked as if she didn't get very much to eat, and not a lot of time to sleep, either. Her hands had been thin and red. Nanny had a lot of time for the Plinges of the world. Did port go with sherry? Well, no harm in trying. All the bells were ringing now. It must be coming up to the interval. She methodically unscrewed the top off a jar of cocktail onions and thoughtfully crunched a couple. Then, as other people started to poke their heads around the doors and make angry demands, she went to the champagne shelf and took down a couple of magnums. She gave them a damn good shake, tucked one under each arm with a thumb on the corks, and stepped out into the corridor. Nanny's philosophy of life was to do what seemed like a good idea at the time, and do it as hard as possible. It had never let her down. The curtains closed. The audience was still on its feet, applauding. "What happens now?" whispered Agnes to the next gypsy. He pulled off his bandana. "Well, dear, we generally nip out to... Oh, no, they're going for a curtain call." The curtains opened again. The light caught Christine, who curtsied and waved and sparkled. Her fellow gypsy nudged Agnes. "Look at Dame Timpani," he said. "There's a nose in a sling if ever I saw one." Agnes stared at the prima donna. "She's smiling," she said. "So does a tiger, dear." The curtains shut once more, with a finality that said the stage manager was going to strike the set and would scream at someone if they dared to touch those ropes again. Agnes ran off with the others. There wasn't too much to do in the next act. She'd tried to memorise the plot earlier, although other members of the chorus had done their best to dissuade her, on the basis that you could either sing them or understand them, but not both. Nevertheless, Agnes was conscientious. So Peccadillo, tenor, the son of Duke Tagliatella, bass, has secretly disguised himself as a swineherd to woo Quizella, not knowing that Dr. Bufola, baritone, has sold the elixir to Ludi, the servant, without realising he is really the maid Iodine, soprano, dressed up as a boy because Count Artaud, baritone, claims that... A deputy stage manager pulled her out of the way and waved at someone in the wings.
"Lose the countryside, Ron."
There was a series of whistles from offstage, answered by another from above. The back cloth rose. From the gloom above, the sandbag counterweights began to descend. Then Artaud reveals that Zebeline must marry Fideli, I mean Fiabi, not knowing that the family fortunes... The sandbags came down, on one side of the stage at least. On the other side, Agnes was interrupted in her impossible task by the screaming, and looked around into the upside-down and not at all well features of the late Dr. Undershaft. Nanny skipped through a handy door, shut it behind her, and leaned on it. After a few moments, the sound of running feet clattered past. Well, that had been fun.
She removed the lace bonnet and apron, and because there was a basic honesty in Nanny, she tucked them in a pocket to give back to Mrs. Plinge later. Then she pulled out a flat, round, black shape and banged it against her arm. The point shot out. After a few adjustments, her official hat was almost as good as new. She looked around. A certain absence of light and carpeting, together with a very presence of dust, suggested that this was part of the place the public weren't supposed to see. Oh, damn. She supposed she had better find another door. Of course, that'd mean she'd have to leave Grebo, wherever he was, but he'd turn up. He always did when he wanted feeding. There was a flight of steps leading down. She followed them to a corridor which was slightly better lit and ambled along it for quite a way, and then all she had to do was follow the screams. She emerged among the flats and jumbled props backstage. No one bothered about her. The appearance of a small, amiable old lady was not about to cause comment at this point. People were running backwards and forwards, shouting. More impressionable people were just standing in one place and screaming. A large lady was sprawled over two chairs having hysterics, while some distracted stagehands tried to fan her with a script. Nanny Ogg was not certain whether something important had happened, or whether this was just a continuation of opera by other means.
"I should loosen her corsets if I was you," she said, as she ambled past.
"Good heavens, madam, there's enough panic in here as it is." Nanny moved on to an interesting crowd of gypsies, noblemen and stagehands. Witches are curious by definition and inquisitive by nature. She moved in.
"Let me through, I'm a nosy person," she said, employing both elbows.
It worked, as this sort of approach generally does. There was a dead person lying on the floor. Nanny had seen death in a wide variety of guises, and certainly knew strangulation when it presented itself. It wasn't the nicest end, although it could be quite colourful.
"Oh, dear," she said, "poor man.
What happened to him?"
"Mr. Bucket says he must have got caught up in the..."
someone began.
"He didn't get caught in anything. This is the ghost's work," said someone else. "He could still be up there."
All eyes turned upwards. "Mr. Salzell has sent some stagehands to flush him out."
"Have they got flaming torches?" said Nanny.
Several of them looked at her as if wondering for the first time who she was.
"What?
Got to have flaming torches when you're tracking down evil monsters," said Nanny. "Well-known fact." There was a moment while this sunk in, and then...
"That's true.
She's right, you know. Well-known fact, dear."
"Did they have flaming torches?"
"Don't think so. Just ordinary lanterns."
"Oh, they're no good," said Nanny. "That's for smugglers' lanterns. For evil monsters, you need flaming torch."
"Excuse me, boys and girls."
The stage manager had stood on the box. "Now," he said, a little pale around the face, "I know you're all familiar with the phrase, the show must go on." There was a chorus of groans from the chorus.
"It's very hard to sing a jolly song about eating hedgehogs when you're waiting for an accident to happen to you," shouted a gypsy king.
"Funny thing, if we're talking about songs about hedgehogs, I myself..." Nanny began, but no one was paying her any attention. "Now, we don't actually know what happened."
"Really? Shall we guess?"
said a gypsy.
"But we have men up in the fly loft now."
"Oh, in case of more accidents."
"And Mr. Bucket has authorised me to say that there will be an additional $2 bonus tonight in recognition of your bravely agreeing to continue with the show."
"Money! After a shock like this, money! He thinks he can offer us a couple of dollars and we'll agree to stay on this cursed stage."
"Shame."
"Heartless."
"Unthinkable. Should be at least four."
"Right, right. For shame, my friends, to talk about a few dollars when there is a dead man lying there. Have you no respect for his memory?"
"Exactly.
A few dollars is disrespectful. $5 are nothing."
Nanny Ogg nodded to herself and wandered off and found a sufficiently big piece of cloth to cover the late Dr. Undershaft. Nanny rather liked the theatrical world. It was its own kind of magic. That was why Esme disliked it, she reckoned. It was the magic of illusions and misdirection and foolery. And that was fine by Nanny Ogg, because you couldn't be married three times without a little fooling. But it was just close enough to Granny's own kind of magic to make Granny uneasy, which meant she couldn't leave it alone. It was like scratching an itch. People didn't take any notice of little old ladies who looked as though they fitted in, and Nanny Ogg could fit in faster than a dead chicken in a maggot factory. Besides, Nanny had one additional little talent, which was a mind like a buzzsaw behind a face like an elderly apple. Someone was crying. A strange figure was kneeling beside the late chorus master. It looked like a puppet with the strings cut.
"Can you give me a hand with this sheet, mister?" said Nanny quietly. The face looked up. Two watery eyes running with tears blinked at Nanny.
"He won't wake up."
Nanny mentally changed gear. "That's right, love," she said. "You're Walter, ain't you?"
"He was always very good to me and our mum. He never gave me a kick."
It was obvious to Nanny that there was no help here. She knelt down and began to do her best with the departed.
"Miss, they say it were the ghost, miss. It weren't the ghost, miss. He'd never do a thing like that. He was always good to me and our mum."
Nanny changed gear again. You had to slow down a bit for Walter Plinge.
"My mum'd know what to do."
"Yes, well, she's gone home early, Walter." Walter's waxy face started to contort into an expression of terminal horror.
"She mustn't walk home without Walter to look after her," he shouted.
"I bet she always says that," said Nanny. "I bet she always makes sure her Walter's with her when she goes home. But I expect that right now she'd want her Walter to just get on with things so she can be proud of him. Show's not half over yet."
"It's dangerous for our mum."
Nanny patted his hand and absent-mindedly wiped her own hand on her dress. "That's a good boy," she said. "Now, I've got to go off..."
"The ghost wouldn't harm no one."
"Yes, Walter, only I've got to go, but I'll find someone to help you, and you must put poor Dr. Undershaft somewhere safe until after the show, understand? And I'm Mrs. Ogg."
Walter gawped at her and then nodded sharply.
"Good boy."
Nanny left him still looking at the body and headed further backstage. A young man hurrying past found that he'd suddenly acquired an Og.
"Excuse me, young man," said Nanny, still holding his arm, "but do you know anyone round here called Agnes? Agnes Knit?"
"Can't say I do, ma'am. What does she do?" He made to hurry on as politely as possible, but Nanny's grip was steel.
"She sings a bit. Big girl, voice with double joints in it. Wears black."
"Oh, you don't mean Perdita?"
"Perdita? Oh, yes, that'd be her, all right.
I think she's singing to Christine. They're in Mr. Salzella's office."
"Would Christine be the thin girl in white?"
"Yes, ma'am.
And I expect you're going to show me where this Mr. Salzella's office is."
"Am I?
Yes. It's just along the stage there, first door on the right."
"What a good boy to help an old lady," said Nanny. Her grip increased to a few ounces short of cutting off circulation. "And wouldn't it be a good idea if you helped young Walter back there do something respectful for the poor dead man?"
"Back where?"
Nanny turned around. The late Dr. Undershaft had gone nowhere, but Walter had vanished.
"Poor chap was a bit upset, I shouldn't wonder," said Nanny. "Only to be expected, so how about if you got another strapping young lad to help you out instead?"
"Yes." "What a good boy," Nanny repeated.